Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series entitled Moving Beyond the Joint, the Interplay Between Gout and Kidney Disease. I'm Dr. Nihad Solomon, a rheumatologist in Phoenix, Arizona, and part of Arizona Arthritis Rheumatology Associates. I'm joined today by my co-host, Dr. Andrew Sherbian.
Hi all, I am Dr. Andrew Sharabim. I am also a rheumatologist at AARA in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm a colleague of Dr. Nihad Solomon's, practicing for a few years and have a very unique interest in gout, and I'm looking forward to our discussion today with Dr. Patel.
In this program, our discussion will focus on several key topics related to the management of patients with gout. We will talk about the crucial role that nephrologists play in diagnosing gout. We'll also discuss available treatment approaches for gout in patients with concomitant chronic kidney disease. We'll also discuss some of the challenges in managing refractory gout and how to address them. We're joined today, as Andy said, by Dr. Sunil Patel. Dr. Patel, can you please introduce yourself?
Good morning, everybody. My name is Dr. Sunil Patel. I am an independent nephrologist in a small town called Victorville in Apple Valley, California. And I've been in solo practice for nearly 10 years. And I run a program which is focused towards gout and treating patients with hyperuricemia, especially those with chronic kidney disease. I have a very keen interest in this. I've been treating gout patients diligently now for last about 3 to 4 years. And so I do look also forward to our conversation this morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Dr. Patel. Thank you for joining us, and let's begin. So, as we know, gout is a common form of an inflammatory arthritis, and it's characterized by deposition of monosodium urate crystals in both the articulations and the periarticular tissues. Can you discuss the primary and secondary causes of gout, sort of what you've seen in your practice over the last 10 years? And this goes out to both Dr. Patel and Dr. Sherbin.
So in my practice, when I'm treating gout, for me, primarily there's a strong association between chronic kidney disease and gout, as well as hyperuricemia, which is the triggering factor for gout. Most of these patients who have chronic kidney disease, as we know, have tenfold increased risk of developing gout. And that mainly has to do with reduce excretion of uric acid. As you are aware, that uric acid it does not excrete easily from human body as is. About 90% of that is resorbed by kidneys after filtration takes place. And so about 10% is excreted. As the kidney function declines, we as humans lose that 10% of availability of regulating uric acid as well.
Well, thank you for that very in-depth discussion with regards to renal disease. Andy, what has been your experience with both primary and secondary causes of gout?
Truly, I can say that I can count on just one hand in the last, let's say, 14 years of how many gout patients I've actually seen with a primary cause in the setting of inborn errors of metabolism, i.e. glycogen storage diseases, et cetera, especially in females that are not postmenopausal, that I've maybe had a handful, two or three. Otherwise, it's mainly what you see statistically common in our patient populations and demographics. Secondary causes, as Dr. Patel had alluded to, this all can stem from this whole chicken and egg scenario of CKD, gout, CKD. But of course, as I always like to mention, there is a something or a role to play and something to be said about lifestyle and habits, these things that can be prevented, these things that can be slowed down or modified. so that we can at least mitigate the risk of such an occurrence, whether it be CKD or gout or both. An approach where we involve both rheumatologists and nephrologists, but reaching out even to our primary care physicians in the community to see how we could all work together to lower the risk of any potential exacerbation or evolution into an advanced state of gout and intercritical states, as we know.
Very nicely said, Andrew. And so clearly, it sounds like at the crux of the problem here is the kidney. And so, really, I guess the question now becomes, what role does the nephrologist have in diagnosing gout? Is that where the patients are? I know in our practice, although the incidence of gout is quite high in the million range, several million range, yet we don't have an inundation of gout patients coming through the door. So it raises the question as to where are they? Are they in EDs? Are they in urgent cares? Are they sitting home waiting for their next flare? Are they seeing nephrologists? We know that there's lots of comorbid conditions that come along with these patients, whether it's diabetes or hypertension. And so I'd love to get the perspective of Dr. Patel as a nephrologist and thinking of what his role is as a nephrologist in diagnosing gout.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail there by, asking the question, where are these patients? Because as you know, statistically, there are 12 million patients suffering from gout across the United States. And all of those places that you mentioned are all appropriate: urgent care, emergency department, primary care physician's office. Gout is often looked at as an acute disease. It's not looked at as a chronic inflammatory disease. So a lot of times these patients end up having a flare, which is acutely treated, and then everybody forgets about them having gout. And they forget that their hyperuricemia in itself is a chronic inflammatory disease. So how does a nephrologist play a role in treating gout? Before treatment options, novel treatment options are have become available, I didn't really have gout as a primary concern. I have to attest that I was looking at gout and hyperuricemia as probably number 10 on my list of diagnosis. Okay. And now it's moved up to number 4, number 5. And the reason being is that I identify now that hyperuricemia is this chronic inflammatory disease process that not only affects the joints, but also affects multiple other organ systems, such as cardiovascular, which is one of the key focus of my practice. And many of the nephrologists is to have that cardiovascular risk modification be inclusive in your practice when you're treating these patients. So this is how I see nephrologists playing a key role in treating hyperuricemia and gout.
Yeah, I think that's it's very critical that we work together as a community in varied specialties to identify the patients and to early aggressively and treat them early with early intervention. So with that, maybe we should touch upon some of the reasons why there may be a delay in timely diagnosis of gout. Andy, you want to tackle that?
Yeah, it'd be a pleasure. I feel that most of our issues lie, that we rely mainly on our patients to step forward and say, "Hey, I think I'm having an issue here. I need to be seen by a physician." This, as we know, has become a bit of a I don't see the catchment of patients that we have that usually suffer from gout being very excited to see doctors. So I think that's the first step to be, more inclined to getting things, quote unquote, checked out if there's something abnormal or something you're not used to as far as your health or your day to day. A lot of people that I know anecdotally, as far as my gout patients are concerned, they tend to just brush things, sweep things under the rug, keep moving forward, suck it up, and just, not consider it as an issue. That would be the first, I would say that would be the top as far as the differential and why we don't catch this early and why no one's coming in for an early diagnosis. The second being that, again, as Dr. Patel alluded to, it's still being seen as an acute disease. It's still, I have so many patients coming in where for the last 5 years, their primary care has just been giving them Indocin or colchicine just to, control that gout attack that's occurring in their big toe on the left. And after they're done with that, they're like, I'm probably going to have another gout attack in 6 months. It's all good. Maybe around the 4th of July, and I'll take care of it with my primary care again, or in the urgent care. So that would be the second there. So I would say it's more just to bring awareness to the community that it is a chronic inflammatory state and disease, and that the more, the earlier we catch it, the more likely you can live your long, unhandicapped life with this disorder as we take it more and more seriously.
Do you think that there may be some stigma associated with gout? Patients may be recognizing that perhaps they're partly to blame, if you will, for some of the flares, if they are very heavy drinkers or they have lots of dietary indiscretion, and there is maybe a level of guilt. I know this is sort of more of a psychosocial dynamic here, but do you think that probably plays a bit more of a role where patients don't want to step up? Maybe they don't want to give up certain foods or certain consumption of alcohol, et cetera, and perhaps may sort of avoid that conversation of chronicity and having to do something for themselves.
I would say that is the top three right there. That's the trifecta. And that's awesome that you brought that up because, yes, there are an innumerable amount of conversations I have with my patients and telling them, this is not your fault. This is your genetic predisposition. First of all, yes, you can be indirectly causing or directly causing your gout attacks, but you were predisposed to this at first, and you need our help to allow for you to live. And obviously we can make modifications, don't overdo it. And as we all say, everything in moderation, it tends to be the best way to go. But you're right, there's sometimes shame, there's sometimes this, I don't want to change my ways, I want to get my beers in on the weekends, and I'll take the gout flare with it. But yes, there is a very negative stigma. There is that kind of apprehension as to what the doctor's going to say and how is he going to, he or she's going to upend my life. How much am I going to have to change? But also, I'm doing this to myself, probably, So it is a conversation where I have to say, this is truly from the get-go, not your fault, but there are things we can do to mitigate. There are things we can do to help you live without worrying about the how bad the next gout attack is going to be. But appreciate you bringing that up. It's a salient point.
And indeed, as we know, diet modification, some lifestyle modification may help, but not really going to change the uric acid levels by more than maybe a point. And with that, really, I'd like to kind of turn it back to Dr. Patel and understand what are some of the factors that can cause challenges or lead to suboptimal treatment in patients with gout who also have impaired renal function. So, sort of more of the pathophysiologic issues that we may run into that are beyond the control of the patient.
Yeah. Well, as you know, the uricosuric agents like probenecid, for example, is very limited in patients with chronic kidney disease because, as you know, we need good renal function in order to utilize medications like that. There's always a concern about hypersensitivity reaction associated with high doses of allopurinol. And also, as we are aware, that allopurinol, despite using maximum doses, there's no real correlation between use of high dose of allopurinol and better results from uric acid standpoint, so lowering of uric acid there. The other drugs like febuxostat, there's a big black box label warning that says, it is of concern in patients with cardiovascular diseases. So, if we're treating and our target is to treat cardiovascular risk factors and modifications, then to me, I think that drug is kind of out of the option in terms of using that. Can you use it? Yes, we can use it in patients who may not have had, for example, a heart attack or prior history of stroke. Those may be an appropriate candidate to use it. I agree with Andy, everything he said about, controlling gout and challenges with patients who do not want to identify that they actually even have gout, and whatever the reasons there may be, whether they're shy, embarrassed of having this disease, because a lot of times they've been told that you are doing this to yourself. Primary care physicians need to recognize, I think, that there is a big genetic predisposition and factors that affect treating hyperuricemia and gout, rather than telling patients that no, you are the ones who are causing this problem for yourself.
Sounds like a very delicate balance between conversations, management of comorbid conditions, treatment options, as well for flares as well as prophylaxis. But let's dive into how you manage your refractory patients with gout. What are the main challenges in refractory gout treatment?
So to me, refractory gout, is a term I think that we should really define as what I would say uncontrolled gout. And if you look at the ACR guidelines, we're looking specifically at the uric acid level of 6 or higher, despite being on the oral urate lowering agents. In addition to dietary health style modifications, having frequent flares and or having a tophi. So that's what I would really, say. It's an uncontrolled gout. And for those patients, a very nice option at this point is KRYSTEXXA, in conjunction with immunomodulatory therapy such as methotrexate or mycophenolate. And so those that's the drug of choice for me when it comes to uncontrolled gout and hyperuricemia, symptomatic hyperuricemia.
And certainly, the lessening the burden on kidney clearance by conversion to allantoin and readily excreting that uric acid. I know that Andy and I have had quite the experience for the last decade or so with this product that you mentioned, KRYSTEXXA, being a uricase, and really how rapidly the uric acid drops, how quickly, in a matter of months, maybe even a year. Where we see a resolution of tophi, which we hadn't seen this in the past with our traditional urate-lowering therapies or uricosurics. And so a very exciting time in the world of gout, but also to some degree, the modification and improvement of renal function in some of our patients that had severe deposition of urate within the kidneys. And so, Andy, what have your experiences been with the use of KRYSTEXXA in these refractory or chronic uncontrolled gout patients?
A word I always like to use is revolutionary. I mean, this is a medication that stands, on a mountain of its own, and and within it's justified. And I can tell you right now that even with the XOIs, the xanthine oxidase inhibitors, over the years, we have patients that have been told you're in remission, your gout is controlled. They're still having flares. They're on allopurinol. Uric acid is 4, 4.5. But if you use imaging modalities or DECT, ultrasound, etc., you find that those tophi are still lingering in there. And as we know, as long as they're lingering in there, they're causing a ruckus. There is chaos in the body, even if it's not notable subjectively or objectively. And what we've realized is those comorbid conditions, your CKDs, your CHFs, cardiovascular implications, they are all mitigated by how quickly you can get rid of that tophaceous burden. And like Dr. Salmon, notes previously, that almost everybody has tophi. We just don't know it yet. With it, there's always some kind of deposition occurring. We just might not catch it quick enough. And I think herein lies the issue. The issue is that, as I always like to say, hit hard, hit fast, or go big or go home. Because at the end of the day, you don't want to linger. You don't want to play catch up with these diseases. You want to be able to get this person and induce remission as quickly as possible, and then maintain them for the future. Not the opposite way. Not the other way around. You don't want to sit there with a little, spoon, and kind of just chisel away at concrete, as opposed to taking a jackhammer to it. right? So that's kind of how I view Krystexxa, and it's been quite, like I said, revolutionary.
Very, very poignant and salient points here. Certainly the revolutionary aspect of Krystexxa, and specifically now a combination with immunomodulation, as Dr. Patel had said, this is something that's been near and dear to our hearts, Andy, in that our practice was one of the first, including Dr. Botson's and Dr. Peterson's practice, to implement various immunomodulatory agents, even before the label expansion, as we know that came on later, but also as a result of the MIRROR trial. But really, not just looking at methotrexate, which is in the label, but other immunomodulatory agents. I know Dr. Patel alluded to mycophenolate. We looked at azathioprine earlier on. We look at leflunomide, certainly in some patients with kidney disease. And so there's a whole plethora of immunomodulatory agents that have been looked at, reported anecdotally, even though the MIRROR study specifically focuses on methotrexate. And I think it's important for our audience that are new to Krystexxa, considering this as an option and may have barriers to use of methotrexate, to recognize that there are other immunomodulatory agents that have been looked at, studied on smaller scales, both anecdotally and in small trials. And so it's critical for us to recognize that. Dr. Patel, have you used Krystexxa with these immunomodulatory agents outside of methotrexate, and what's your experience been?
Yes, and Hadi, as you're aware of the RECIPE trial looking at use of mycophenolate as an immunomodulator instead of the methotrexate. First thing I actually want to say is, as a nephrologist, whenever we see the word methotrexate, we run far from it. And I don't know why that is. Maybe it's because methotrexate in high doses has been known to cause nephrotoxicity. And it's because probably we're not comfortable in using it because we don't use it in our training. I think that's probably where it has to stem from. That being said, I've had a very good experience and results with using methotrexate, even in moderately advanced chronic kidney disease patients, those patients who have GFR of more than 30. Now, it's kind of controversial to use methotrexate in patients with GFR of less than 30, but I've used it with adjusting the doses of methotrexate and monitoring methotrexate levels. And as well as monitoring cell counts and liver function tests in these patients. So I think that I've come to a point where I feel very comfortable using methotrexate, even if in the lower doses in the MIRROR trial, 15 milligrams was recommended with use of folic acid for the methotrexate to be given on a weekly basis and the folic acid on a daily basis to counteract the effects of the methotrexate to give the folic acid as a supplemental nutrient. But again, I think that using methotrexate is equally good as using CellCept or mycophenolate. We as nephrologists, we have training in treating lupus nephritis, other immune glomerulonephritis, as well as other various conditions like post-transplant patients. Because we commonly use mycophenolate, we feel comfortable using mycophenolate. And I think that use of mycophenolate is definitely safe in kidney disease patients, even with advanced kidney disease patients. And it doesn't really require that much of a dose adjustment in advanced chronic kidney disease patients as well. And the RECIPE trial shows equally effective in terms of outcomes when you're using Krystexxa to treat hyperuricemia, symptomatic hyperuricemia in gout patients.
Thank you for that, Dr. Patel. And so with that, we've delved into quite the detail on Krystexxa and immunomodulation, knowing that we want to implement the immunomodulation about a month before initiating Krystexxa. But what about about, for those folks who, for whatever reason, can't take Krystexxa, perhaps for contraindication, maybe they have D6PD, or perhaps have had an infusion reaction in rare instances, et cetera. Any experimental or investigational agents out there that you're aware of? I know that there is an agent called SEL-212, and there's a DISSOLVE trial. Can you give us your impressions on the mechanism of action of this new product, as well as the results of the trial so far?
Yeah, so I think there are two phases on this trial, right? There are two trials actually, DISSOLVE 1 and DISSOLVE 2. What's basically it's looking at is delivering a nano technology, nanoparticle of immunomodulator Rapamune, which is concomitantly given with a different formulation of uricase. The results, are there. And I think at best they're showing about 40 to 50% efficacy in using this combination. I believe the FDA is still reviewing for approval. It's not out yet. Whether it'll be out or not will be a different story. I think that there is some role in using that particular combination, and I think that role may be in those patients who may prove refractory to using Krystexxa with oral immunomodulators. And the reason why I say this is, look, not every patient's, will respond to oral immunomodulators, right? There's a lot of metabolic variances that we have, absorption, how the drug is metabolized in our body. And so in those rare cases where, pegloticase is not an option with using immunomodulator in an oral form, I think that this particular modality and technology may be of some use there. At the end of the day, we want to be treating our patients, whether we use pegloticase or we use this new drug. We want to give our patients best chance to treat gout and hyperuricemia, as we know that this is a really deleterious disease when it comes to our patients.
Certainly a fascinating and exciting time in the world of gout and management of gout. I guess in closing, just a few things. One, it sounded like we really need to improve education amongst healthcare providers at the level of primary care specialists, sort of zeroing in on the fact that this is a chronic, serious systemic disease as opposed to an episodic, acute disease. But also educate our patients and sort of help them own, if you will, the reality of the chronic systemic nature of this disease and the need for regular follow-up, whether it be with their primary care doctor or their specialist, rheumatologist, nephrologist, et cetera. And so, would either of you guys like to offer any kind of additional educational resources, whether it be for our healthcare providers that may be listening and tuning in, or our patients?
Yeah, Nihad, I think, there's lots and lots of information available. Just we live in a modern technological world, AI, ChatGPT. It's funny, I was playing with ChatGPT this morning and just asked a question about what are the treatment options for gout and hyperuricemia. And you get this whole list of, treatment options, including dietary modifications, et cetera, et cetera. So there's definitely plenty of resources available out there for patients and physicians who want to know further about this. Krystexxa has a education website as well for healthcare providers that can be shared and looked on the Amgen's web page as well. So I think as far as that, but I think also more so, having these kind of webcasts and medcasts, educating and targeting physicians who may be attracted to treating gout and who may see certain population that have high propensity of gout, but they're not really implementing these novel treatments. I think that that's kind of more the way to go is to just get the word out there, educate as many people as we can, including patients. And like Andy had said earlier, you know, patients are their own advocate. If they come into the office telling you that they have this condition that they're suffering from and they want to be treated, that is where I think the golden point would be for to get started on offering proper treatment for the patients.
Thank you, Dr. Patel. Appreciate that. And so I really want to thank both of you for this very rich and informative discussion. And thanks to our audience for tuning in. And if you've enjoyed this content, please subscribe to our e-newsletters to receive upcoming MedCast episodes and other great content in your inbox. Thank you.